Chapter 10. The Way Home. Archimandrite, Mistress of the Black Fleet. Hieronima, that redoubtable arch-priestess of the Ordo Reductor, didn't scream, even when they drilled out her eyes. She was a war priestess of the Unmaker God, responsible for the nerve-stripping torture of countless thousands of prisoners and criminals, binding them into holy robotic shells through sacred rituals. Given her role and authority, she had deadened most of her nerves along with her conscience. It was simply the way of things. The procedure was never going to be painless, having been responsible for much of the schematics that her reforging was operating from, she was well aware of the torment involved. Willingly, she made the sacrifice, offering up her flesh for transmogrification and ascension. Her operator surgeons expected her to show her pain. It had been calculated in the factors of reforging, which made her even more eager to show no reaction at all. She couldn't stop the ticks and twitches of dead nerves briefly rekindled to life, but she could at least prevent herself screaming aloud. She had done so with a minor and forgivable deception, however. Before the surgeries began, she had removed her vocal cords during her isolated preparations. The only sounds she could make at all were sighing, weakling huffs. She had to be awake for the process itself, so her neural activity could be carefully monitored. The physical implants were only a portion of her ascension. The mental implantation was of greater importance. Arkan Land was present by virtue of expertise, if not by rank. At his side was Diocletian, the custodian present by virtue of the fact no one had the authority to tell him to go anywhere else. They remained outside the surgery chamber, with Diocletian watching the operation taking place, and Land watching the data feeds flooding into Hieronima's mind. 7 monitors, each fed with separate cogitators, spilled reams of code across their flickering faces. Land stared, scratching his bald head, doing his very best to follow what he was seeing unfold. He had provided the schematics and references for the machinery necessary to cradle unequaled degrees of law in a semi-biological brain. He had added recovered plans and schema from his personal collection to weaponize the tech priestess beyond anything her Ordo had seen before. It had been with a heavy heart he'd passed over the forbidden texts from his deepest excavations, but truth be told, that weight came with no shortage of curiosity. If all went according to plan, those weapon systems would be instrumental in retaking sacred Mars. Now all he could do was wait and see if Hieronima survived. He doubted she would. Land was under no illusions that she would come through the surgery itself, a staggeringly unlikely outcome, let alone survive long enough to lead them back to Mars via this so-called Arisian path. Given his doubts, one might then ask why he had agreed to the Archimandrite venture at all. The answer was deliciously, ambitiously simple. Agreement with the Fabricator General's desperate hopes had been the only way to learn all of the details pertaining to the Emperor's great work. And, oh, the things Land was learning. Much as a painting was formed not only of pigments and water and parchment, but also the individual hairs that made up a brush and the years of expertise at the artist's fingertips, the many layered codes running through the cogitators amounted to one thing. A map. A map in impossible dimensions of a realm that couldn't exist. A map that was being poured piecemeal into Hieronima's mind. He smiled as he watched the data flood. Poured into is the wrong term, Land thought. More like etched upon. The pain must have been monumental, even to her stripped nervous system. Having a world's worth of data inloaded like this would send reason screaming from the mortal consciousness. Frankly, he was impressed she was still alive 4 hours into the procedure. If she survived, it would be unlikely that Hieronima would be able to entertain any other thoughts in her skull. The map would swallow her consciousness, and all of her concentration. It was simply that vast. Through the viewing window, he caught sight of Hieronyma thrashing on the surgical table. The attendants, the Fabricator General among them, were bleating and murmuring about convulsions. The immense metal limbs of Hieronyma's new form crashed and twitched. A huge three-barreled energy cannon rotated on her forearm, trying to fire, whirring in starvation. A tremor of the nervous system, most likely, or a randomly firing synapse in the brain. He doubted she was genuinely trying to kill the surgeons attending her, though. Well, with what was going on in her mind, one couldn't be sure. Land took no particular joy in the pain she must be feeling, but nor did her torment exactly inspire him to the precious heights of sympathy. She chose this fate, after all. The yearning of homesickness had driven her to it, which Land could understand, and even consider admirable in its rather petulant earnestness. But she'd also been led by her faith in the Fabricator General, and that was something the techno-archaeologist considered endlessly mystifying. He returned his attention to the map's code, partly due to the worry it would stop flowing once Hieronyma died. He had to learn what he could while there was still time. The heart of the map was a city. It had catacombs, which were a labyrinth with several hundred passages abruptly severed or otherwise unfinished, and thousands of other routes leading out from its edges like capillary veins. The city existed in 360 degrees, as if it covered the entire inside of a great shaft or tunnel. It called to mind the tales of old Earth space installations that rolled in the void to create artificial gravity, though this city was ultimately motionless. It merely existed, static, at every angle, including the impossible ones. Nor were the city and its catacombs the entirety of the map. They weren't even the majority of it. From the city's edges, thousands of capillary tunnels branched out in a seemingly endless and random network, following no sense of human order and leading to no specific destinations. Land could grasp all of this. That wasn't the problem. No, the problem was the way the map evolved, even as it was being imprinted within Hieronyma's mind. It shifted and changed moment by moment, as if the realm it was mapping had only the loosest relationship with the corporeal flow of time. Since the expeditionary teams had started surveying this hidden region, thousands upon thousands of subtle shiftings had occurred, as if the labyrinth reacted to something, some outward pressure, and sought to stabilize itself. And all of the shifts, in excruciating detail, were being scarred into Hieronyma's brain. The map code's intricacies would have been on the edge of mortal comprehension, even in three dimensions. In four, it was almost laughably, terrifyingly fascinating. In the surgical chamber, Hieronyma's mouth worked in silent futility. Land spared a moment to watch Kane injecting her with something pale blue and milky, something that in no way lessened her thrashing and completely failed to stabilize her spiking vital signs. As her head bucked, its bevy of mechanical replacements bared without her hood, Land saw her staring through the chamber's window, right at him. Her eye lenses revolved and refocused. He was certain he detected something pleading in her machine gaze, and, perhaps, something of regret. Land looked back to the monitors. On and on the data streamed. Soon the cartography and chronology were joined by archival data that defied belief, let alone possibility. Scans and analyses made by the Unifier caste tech priests, quantifying the nature of the realm in which they worked and the foes they faced. Land's eyes widened, his mouth slowly, almost delicately parted and hung open. In the chamber, the threshing, writhing machine that Hieronyma was becoming suddenly fell still, motionless but for her trembling. "Teeth of the cog," said Land. Awe softened his curse to a whisper. His eyes flickered. A realm of psychically resistant passageways. A realm that existed not within the warp, but in spite of it. A realm that allowed travel across vast distances without ever once entering the reach of the warp's unreliable and treacherous tendrils. A realm that shifted as part of its resistance to the warp's corrosive touch, realigning itself to remain immune. A web. A webway. His eyes flickered. A realm flooded by warp entities. Beings formed from hatred and madness and emotion. Creatures born of every emotion ever felt, taking form and twisted behind the veil of reality. Monsters formed of the warp's matter and flooding into this ancient, precious sanctuary. His eyes flickered. A realm shattered by Magnus the Red. A realm gouged open with lethal wounds in its protective psychic sheath. A realm sundered by immense releases of sorcerous power that allowed the infection of these beings, the demons, to spread. His eyes flickered, shining with the threat of tears. Vulnerabilities, weaknesses in the process, signs of decay in the alien-made sections of the webway, and worse, the flaws of incomplete human knowledge in the Mechanicum-built sections. They weren't psychically sheathed, as the ancient and original structures were. The human-engineered halls of the endless labyrinth were protected by... His eyes flickered, and now he wept. A great machine. A machine of such power and purity as to defy mortal thought. A throne of gold, built to house the Emperor's power. The Omnisire's throne, the seat of the machine god himself, harnessing and focusing his psychic might into the webway, bolstering the Mechanicum-made conduits. A soul engine that roared power into this secret and sacred realm, shielding the Mechanicum's iron and steel against the demons clawing against it. His eyes flickered and streamed with awed tears, just as ancient Terran tales told of men and women weeping before the faces of their false gods. The abandonment of the Great Crusade, the appointment of Horus as War Master, the Emperor's retreat into the Imperial Dungeon, the treachery of Magnus the Red, the Custodian Guard, the Silent Sisterhood, the Unifiers, the war in the Webway, the Emperor's great work, the magnum opus that was the very reason the Omnisire had reached up into the night sky and united the two empires of Mars and Terra. It was for this. It was all for this. It was all for this. And through the disobedience of a Primarch, the ignorance of a weapon that moronically believed itself a man, the magnum opus stood upon the precipice of failure. His eyes closed. Finally, as Hieronima wheezed her last breath upon the table where she had been promised rebirth, at long last, Arkan Land understood.
"I must come with you," he said, turning to Diocletian.
The need in his voice bordered upon begging. He gripped the custodian's bracer, staring up at the warrior's impassive faceplate.
"I must join you in the great work."
The custodian had stood in silence during the entirety of the surgery. He moved for the first time, turning to look down at the techno-archaeologist through emotionless eye lenses. The whine of flatlining vital signs echoed in the air around both men.
"Well, she keeps dying," was Diocletian's reply. "You said this was the preparatory phase of the surgery."
"Custodian, please."
Diocletian looked back into the chamber, his features clear of any emotion. Something shivered inside the priestess's skull. It curled and uncurled with revolting physicality, a tendril of prehensile ice dredging her brain matter. Its tremors caused no pain, but the pressure of its presence was the burden of high gravity applied directly to her skull and spine. She felt hunched, compacted, and the moment she tried to stretch to free herself was the moment she realized she wasn't breathing. Not only that she wasn't, she couldn't. Heaving in to breathe met a wall of solid cold barricading her throat. Her lungs didn't even twitch.
Her body didn't answer her urges to rise, to fight, to thrash, to do anything at all, to breathe, breathe, breathe.
"Pulmonary instability," said a voice, distant, dispassionate, sacred in its serenity, without identity in the reddening black of her blindness. "Mark the 9th instance. Illuminate her."
Code flared through her reddening senses, numerals written in fire upon the wet meat of her mind. Its meaning eluded her. She screamed in mouthless, breathless silence. "Pulmonary spasms," came another voice, just as cold, just as enlightened.
"Teeth of the cog. She is trying to breathe again.
Illuminate her."
Acid numerals raked across the inside of her skull again. For all the pain of them, they were more distant now. Harder to see, impossible to read. Strangling on her own silence, drowning in uncolour, she fell silently, screaming away from everything.
Illumin.
The tendril uncurled slowly through the silt and sludge of her mind, coaxing her back. She felt slow, dense. Her blood and thoughts alike turned sludgy with toxins. Dazed, drained, and strangled, she fought to open her eyes.
"Reactivation,"
said a voice from beyond.
"I can't breathe. I can't breathe. I can't breathe."
"Convulsions, pulmonary spasms, mark the 10th inst-"
"Illuminate her before—"
The words weren't fire or acid this time. They were pain itself, scrawled directly onto the inside of her skull with talons of code. She stared at them. She felt them. She knew them. She stopped trying to drag air through the blockage in her throat.
"Stabilizing."
"Praise the Omnisire." She felt air whisper into her system, then flood her, cold and purified and rich in as much incense as oxygen. She could only breathe when she didn't try to breathe. When she tried to work lungs she no longer had, she overrode the automated systems that respired for her.
"Awakening."
She opened her eyes.
The world exploded in red-stained holy light. Target locks saturated her vision. Prayer text and sacred code bathed her sight in layers of algebraic mandalas. Beneath what she could see was what she knew. A latticework map of impossible spatial distances that defied conventional physics. She shut that madness away and turned from the knowledge for now, needing to focus only on the immediacy of her surroundings. Hooded faces and surgical servitors looked down at her. No, not down. Up. She had thought she would be lying on her back, but the faces tilted towards hers were below her. She was bound to a standing gurney. Bindings cracked away in sweet hisses of released air pressure. Grinding machinery lowered her the half meter to the ground as the last cabling snapped free. Behind the worshipful surgery priests and their mind-locked cyborg slaves, a heavily augmented corpse lay upon another table. The cadaver was ostensibly female, headless, gored through autopsy, Medicaid drilling and organ harvesting. She knew that corpse. Even headless, its remains were brutally familiar.
"Hieronymus," the priestess thought. "Me. I."
Her clawed foot ground down on the polished metal floor. It shook the chamber.
"Archimandrite,"
said one of the hooded priests. Tall, many-armed, savagely weaponized.
"Sagreus Cain, divine bishopric of the cult mechanicum fabricator general of sacred Mars, my lord, my master."
The knowledge was there once she accessed the data stream, albeit with a slight delay.
"Fabricator general," she said.
Her voice, even to her own ears, was almost wholly human, a vox simulation of her biological tone. At the sound of her voice, several of the adepts went to their knees, murmuring a mono-note Om prayer, linking their knuckles in the sign of the cog.
"Do you know?"
Cain asked, rumbling forwards on his tracked lower half.
"Do you see the way back to Mars?"
Her second step shook the chamber, the same as the first. As did the third. As did the fourth.
As the weeks passed after the Archimandrite's rebirth, Diocletian found himself alone more often than not. Kyria was gone. He knew not where, only that she was dealing with the secret intricacies of her silent order elsewhere in the palace. He had little to say to Baroness Darkus and her knightly kindred, nor did he find much worth in the stoic computations of the Mechanicum's various overseers. Two souls consistently sought out his company, the pleading figure of Arkan Land and the serenely lost presence of Dominion Zephon. Now that the Archimandrite venture had succeeded, Diocletian had no further use for the former. He would likely allow the techno-archaeologist to join the expedition back to the Impossible City, even if only on the rare chance the explorator's knowledge would prove useful. And as for the Blood Angel, the so-called Bringer of Sorrow, would serve well enough merely by accompanying them into the webway when the time came. It was the delay that wore the custodian's patience. The Mechanicum's requisition supplies were already proceeding through in a convey stream. Thousands of battle servitors, tracked conveyors, robots, and even the rare Sicarii funneled through to their fates within the great work. The first shipments would already have reached Ra by now, reinforcing the Impossible City. And yet, Diocletian waited, impatient but without any show of temper. House Viridian drew ever closer to war readiness. The Archimandrite was adjusting to its new form and its enhanced cognition. Things were proceeding as expected, even if not with a swiftness Diocletian would have preferred. His place was to oversee every item of requisition, and he wouldn't return to Kalistar without doing so. He felt no frustration in doing his duty, only the vague concern that he could better be serving the Emperor elsewhere. Next to Ra, on the walls of Kalistar, perhaps, or slowing the foe in the outer tunnels, making them pay for each meter of misted ground they took. Something proactive, something where he felt as though he were contributing to the defence of his master's vision. The one thing he was not, however, was bored. He spent much of his time isolated within the Tower of Hegemon, the command corps of the Legio Custodes' efforts in the Emperor's defence. Here, Diocletian watched the continual streams of population data, materiel transport, and the aerial and orbital traffic entering and exiting the solar system, maintained by bank upon bank of cogitators and life-bonded savant serfs in robes of imperial scarlet. These data artisans, each one tattooed with the Aquila, dwelled within the watchroom, where only those life-sworn to the Emperor were permitted. Rather than the dregs enslaved and augmented by the machine cult of Mars, none of the 10,000 serfs were cyborged to their stations or bound to live and die in their life support cradles. These men and women had sworn themselves to the all-seeing eye of the Emperor's custodians. They wore jewelry of sculpted bone, made from the bodies of their mothers and fathers who served before them, and of the grandparents before them. In time, their mortal remains would be harvested, and ritual trinkets of their own bones gifted to their specifically bred children. To serve the custodian guard wasn't merely a life sentence. It was an eternal, generational one. Much of the watchroom's information centered on the palace itself, with unified biometric verification feeds forming a living web of several million souls entering and exiting the palace's myriad districts. Diocletian watched this calculation of life taking place. Perhaps another soul might have seen something harmonic or musical in the display. Even among the 10,000, such vigils usually took note of the hundreds of potential infiltration threats that might somehow slip past even the imperial fists. Yet Diocletian saw something unexpected in the patternless mess. He saw diminishing supplies, even as Terra itself was broken down for materials, even as the Himalaya mountains themselves were ground down for rock and ore. He saw fewer and fewer convoy fleets reaching the solar system as the war raged on. He saw Terra strangled beneath the weight of off-world refugees, devouring their way through ever-diminishing resources. He saw fewer and fewer successful attempts to land reinforcements on Mars, or bring materiel back through the Imperial blockade. He saw all of this written as plainly as the 871 words of his full name, laser etched upon the inside of his breastplate, as familiar to him as the weight of the spear in his hands. Defeat. He was looking at defeat. The rebels were winning the war. Though their conquests across the galaxy were far from absolute, Horus didn't need wholesale victory among the stars. The Warmaster needed only to amass enough support on the way to Terra and deny Imperial reinforcement reaching the solar system. And, overwhelmingly, these ugly calculations painted a portrait of the Warmaster doing just that. Diocletian spent several days immersing himself in the reports and cogitations, seeking a wider view of the escalating conflict. It was in studying the movements of the rarest of all Imperial resources, the 10,000 and the Silent Sisterhood not currently deployed in the Webway, that he discovered something tentative in the millions of cogitations. Something in the pattern was flawed, and it gnawed at Diocletian. Silent sections of code revealed shadows in the streaming figures. Equations were buried in the cogitations that returned half-truths as answers. Data deletions, he first wondered. But no. These weren't holes in the pattern, merely patches of occlusion, shrouded, not deleted, hidden, not forbidden. Diocletian followed the patterns, watching them unfurl with a savant's understanding of mathematic and algebraic principles. At first, it seemed the serfs were themselves ignorant of the patterns, but soon enough he realized this wasn't so. They were clearly aware. They were simply not flagging the curious elements for archival examination. He saw fleets of ships in the numbers.
We have an entire fleet out there scattered across three segmentums, sailing the stars, avoiding the war.
And more than that, displacement calculations and void logistical data suggested these ships would descend on loyal worlds in the days and weeks before Horus's forces committed to an invasion. Yet they extracted nothing of any military significance. They landed no reinforcements, and they evacuated none of the established regent governments put in place by the Great Crusade.
What, then, are they doing?
None of the vessels were accounted for in the Great Crusade's tallies, each one unattached to any expeditionary fleets. Nor were their dealings translated off-world, with no word transmitted by common routes. Nothing from the divisions of the Astra Telepathica, and
there.
Word had come in the form of a cursory transmission by a modest rogue trader fleet returning from the spiral arm of the Halo Stars. Her family's armada had been negotiating for orbital resupply above the capital city of some nameless backwater still going by its allocated colonial code, when one of these logistically occluded vessels showed itself. Despite its obvious Imperial allegiance, it had refused all communication, completed several planetary operations, and left orbit for the system's Mandeville point without illuminating the rogue trader fleet as to its purpose. The trader Scion's report concluded with a message from the planet itself, stating what little dealings its provincial quorum government had managed to have with the ship's commander, including the vessel's intent.
They came for our psychically attuned citizens.
Diocletian breathed a disbelieving laugh.
A black ship? The black ships of the Silent Sisterhood are sailing across three segmentums, unescorted, hiding from battle and harvesting psychers on an unprecedented scale. And they are doing it practically unseen by anyone, oath-binding whole governments to silence.
Once he knew what ships were causing the flaws in the galactic pattern, the calculations solved themselves. Dozens of similarly shrouded equations noted black ships in Terra's orbit, committing shuttles, loaders, and transports of cargo to the planet's surface without registering upon terrestrial traffic. And dozens more were drawing towards Terra from across the galaxy. Diocletian had a fair suspicion of just where Kyria had gone. He turned to a nearby serf at a cogitation console and narrowed his eyes.
You.
The worker halted but didn't look away from his screen. Numeric runes flashed upon his unblinking eyes.
Golden one?
Arrange for a vox link to the Magadan orbital construct. I wish to speak with the mistress of the Black Fleet.
It came as no surprise to Diocletian when, 2 hours later, he saw a familiar figure on the crackling hololith connection. Kyria stood at the side of a robed and cowled fellow sister, the former armed and armored, just as Diocletian had last seen her, the latter with her eyes hidden by the fall of her hood. The mistress of the black ships wore leather gloves with reinforced knuckles and dagger-length knives for fingernails. In the rippling hollow image, she seemed to be clicking them together.
Mistress Veronica,
he greeted the spindly creature clad in black, adding, Sister Kyria, a moment later. The older sister wove an elaborately formal greeting with her brutal finger blades. Kyria offered no more than a nod. Diocletian wasted no time. The door to the communications suite was sealed. He was entirely alone, bathed in blue hollow light.
What is the Black Fleet doing?
Both sisters signed a reply at once, curt, without rudeness.
And what is the unspoken sanction?
Another brief reply, one that Diocletian had expected.
Forbidden, Diocletian replied.
Well, the Sisters of Silence were entitled to their secrets in the Emperor's service. Never would they act without the Emperor's command.
Where are you housing these harvested psychos?
He asked. Again, a curt reply from both sisters. Forbidden.
Be that as it may, the custodian replied. You cannot ship tens of thousands of psychos to Terra and hide them indefinitely. Have you taken their sustenance into consideration? Half of the Throne World's granaries already stand hollow. Water farms across the Afric swathe stand mute in rainless thirst.
He expected another blunt, curt response. To his mild surprise, Veronica replied by signing a longer reply with both hands. Diocletian could almost imagine the click-clack of her bladed talons meeting on several of the words.
Then I will press no more on the matter, said the custodian. But in the Emperor's name, tell me whether I might expect reinforcements in the webway as a result of your scheming.
The merest flicker of the older sister's finger blades was enough to betray her hesitation. She signed a negative response. But Diocletian found her hesitation intriguing.
Very well. Am I to assume you will be returning when I lead House Viridian and the Archimandrite's convoy into the dungeon, Kyria?
The Oblivion Knight bowed her head once more formally this time. He needed no sign language to see her respect in the reply, nor any further explanation to note her refusal. She was staying there.
So be it. Good eve, sisters.
Diocletian terminated the link and exhaled slowly. He knew better than to pry further into whatever secrets they sought so ardently to protect. If they required his aid, they would ask for it. The custodian turned back to the closest bank of monitors, resuming the staring absorption of limitless scrolling data.